Well, this is kind of a free-flowing, philosophical, sort of view of what else might have been done and what else remains to be done.
The economics of theoretical mathematics,
Top 2? Yeah, that's one we could look at. So one of the issues is in this subject, as in many others, is problems versus techniques. And there's sort of two ways that mathematical research evolves. One is through the articulation of problems, which one then scans the whole domain of feasible techniques for and then tries to solve. And the other one is one which takes an idea, a theme, and then tries to push and develop and explore that theme as far as possible. And certainly in the cases that we've examined, we've used both of those ideas. And we'll see what more that has also. Another issue that shows up is importation within a subject is the importation and exportation of both problems and techniques. The problems we've looked at, some of these problems have been imported from computer science, some have been imported from combinatorial theory, and some from operations research. And the techniques, we've mainly focused on probabilistic techniques, but some of those actually had their origins in such places as probability and Banach spaces. In particular, a lot of this isoperimetric theory evolved because people had desire to understand the basic probability theorems of random variables with values in Banach spaces. Although by the time they got down to us, we didn't look at that so much. Now, we've got some other interesting ideas about the export of this. To some extent, the problems of probabilistic combinatorial optimization were exported into the domain of isoperimetric theory, where they became interesting illustrative examples for tools like Talligrands. There haven't been so far, but we look at things on a kind of a funny time scale. Time scales of mathematics are really quite odd, and there are some illustrations of this time scale issue in that if you take any given issue of your favorite journal 10 years ago, go back, look at a 10-year-ago journal, boy, those were interesting articles. You know, not like that irrelevant stuff they're doing today. And this is a time invariant statement, evidently. Okay, so there's something about our ability to appreciate and perceive and soak in and understand the relationships of the stuff that just showed up on our desk today that's not so true about the stuff that showed up on our desk 10 years ago. So we don't quite know the right time scale at which to look at things. That's a thing. That's a sense in which we're slow in understanding even what we're doing. There's another sense in which things are slow, in that, of course, nowadays, if you have an idea today and it takes you a year to really work it out well, and then you write it up and you send it off, that's a 3-year process. And if you caught 3.5 years, that's about the amount of time that the United States was in the Second World War. You might think that more change had taken place in that world than actually takes place. So sometimes things are fast scales, sometimes they're slow scales. So we don't quite know what techniques that we've involved are really going to have a substantial impact for a while. And now those are the first two items. And before I do look at the problems, I want to complete everybody's juggling education. Okay. So, no balls, tray playing, one ball, two balls, three balls, and a stop. Three balls and a stop. Three balls and a stop. At that point, you got all the ingredients. You can just keep juggling. And then, at that point, you can define yourself to be a person who knows how to juggle. And then the question is, what's next? And there's a good what's next, and there's a bad what's next. The bad what's next is to try to add another ball. It's frustrating, not very much fun, takes a long time. The fun what's next is patterns, additional patterns with three balls. So with this, you have what's called the cascade, and there's a way to reverse it called the reverse cascade. A little bit harder, a little bit wilder, but you see the notion of a pattern. It's a little bit tighter, reverse cascade. And there are also lots of little variations like this guy. Okay. So patterns are a useful thing to evolve, and when you've done some juggling, then that's the next thing, and flipping things behind your back is the next thing, and then clubs is the next thing, and then passing balls back and forth to your friends, and passing clubs back and forth to your friends is the next thing. And only after all you've done that to the tune that you can just do that and all these marvelous patterns that you start worrying about incremental balls. Okay? That's the theory of juggling completely explained. Now, the applications of juggling, of course, numerous. Now, here are, I think, the sort of the digested list of standout problems. We can invent lots of problems, and some of these are useful to work out, and they'll teach you something, they'll illustrate a technique, and they might be worth writing up. But some would definitely get the attention of anybody who's thought about any of this stuff. And here are some that would definitely get my attention if there were progress made on them. The central limit theorem for either the traveling salesman problem, which just seems very remote at this point, I think has to have a pride of place as the most outstanding single problem. Okay. Because of the progress of Keston and Lee, the problem which is probably more tractable than the TSP, but still represent quite a substantial challenge, but a feasible challenge, a more feasible challenge than the TSP, is to prove the center limit theorem for minimum matching. Okay? Minimum matching has the benefit that there's a reasonably tractable polynomial time algorithm, so you're not stuck at some computational domain. It also has a connection to linear programming. It has duality. It has many variations and a very substantial literature of algorithms and structural results. So there's lots of ways to make progress on that problem, and it will be very valuable progress. And matching is one of the deepest and richest parts of combinatorial optimization that's been achieved. There's harder stuff, but if you look, say, at Lovaas and Plummer, you realize, there's a nice, dense, order 600-page book on matching. We know a lot about matching. Okay, so I think those are very important problems, very worth pursuing. There are some other problems which involve, they're maybe less standout problems, but I still think they're quite interesting and important. And that mainly because that teaches something about this technique and this paradigm that we've explored, whereby you start with a big O result, and you'd like to pursue that big O result to genuine or honest asymptotics. The idea is often smoothing plus some sort of approximate recursion relationship plus some sort of argument, which one could call a Tauberian or unsmoothing argument. We don't have any serious idea about how to do that in the two-sample problem or the Itai Komolosh-Tushnady theorem. One surely suspects that Tn, the length of the shortest two-sample matching on two random samples from an inset, converges to a genuine constant. But that's really quite out of reach by what we know right now. It can't be done, to my understanding or to my intuition, by the transportation method. So it would require new insights. I'm on less sure ground, but it certainly would be natural and interesting to see what could be done in the case of upright matching or the other phenomenon related to both the surprising factors of log n or log to the 3/4 n. Those are serious, interesting asymptotic problems that would need a new idea based on the things that we've said before. Okay. Now, in terms of constants galore, there are many, many more constants that we can't find than we can find. And anytime you've got too many problems of a sort, then there's kind of a diffusion of interest. Here are some that I'm particularly interested in that I think are special. Certainly, the TSP constant in dimension 2 has had a lot of people work on it, a lot of people think about aspects of it, serious simulations done on it with both algorithms and computational tools that are beyond the usual level of resources. So determination of the TSP constant in dimension 2, I think any serious progress on that would be quite welcome. Certainly less central, but engaging to me because there's a good numerical guess is the possibility that long common subsequence for coin flips has the limit constant 2 divided by 1 plus the square root of 2. Part of the charm of this is that we have a guess at the constant. If we don't even have a guess at the constant, then somehow the constants are less engaging than if we had that guess. One in the same vein, but which the heuristic is much more substantially developed, is the assertion of Mezard and Parisi is that in the assignment problem with uniform cost, that the asymptotic value is equal to pi squared over 6. That's a case where you have a statistical mechanical process argument that leads to a defined value, and then the task becomes making rigorous a statistical mechanical argument. But we know that there exists, you know, many conferences and many journals and many people every year who work on the process of, here's a statistical mechanical argument, what can you prove rigorously about it? And the sad fact of statistical mechanics is that they've got millions and millions of results that and only a tiny subset of those have been brought to the level of rigorous understanding. Okay. Probably the least central of these, but one which is probably possibly tractable, is the case of the minimum matching constant in dimension 2. That's the case where you drop endpoints at random in the unit square, you look at the least cost way to tie these in pairs, and we know that if you divide that by the square root of n, it converges to a constant. And it's quite possible that we'd be able to get this limit constant. Sort of for the same reason that in the hierarchy of complexity, the simplest problem, still damn complicated, but the simplest problem is the minimum spanning tree problem, which you can solve by a greedy algorithm. The next hardest in this three-piece hierarchy is the minimum matching problem, for which there exist polynomial times algorithms, but which require backtrack, which are not greedy. And then the hardest are, of course, the traveling salesman type problems for which there exists no tractable algorithm. Now, sometimes the probability theory of something like the TSP is easier because of monotonicity. So the complexity theory doesn't map necessarily into the probability theory. There are other geometric properties that can show up as being of importance one to the other. But somehow the complexity theory does give some perspective about what's hard and what's not. Okay, so that's my set of the standout problems. And I would not be surprised to see serious progress on some of these in the next 10 years. But on the other hand, I wouldn't be surprised if in the next 10 years we know not particularly more about any of these than we know now. Okay, these are problems as opposed to techniques. And in a problem, there's no guarantee that you're going to make any progress at all. If a technique, you know, if you're exploring a technique, you know, if you just sit down and do your work, eventually something will come out. In these cases, we don't really know that anything will necessarily come out. But they're my favorites. Okay. All right. Now, some bit about what else is in this business. there exists a huge enterprise, which, by the way, when you invent, it's an interesting human property that when you invent something, you like to get acknowledged for the invention of this. And sometimes your kind of generous colleagues won't do this, so you have to give yourself credit for the invention of things. One of the things that occurs out there in Vopnik Chervoninkis land, which is a widely used standard term for which I get no credit. I feel like Buchanan when I use it. Nobody gives Buchanan any credit. But this word for shattered, the word shattered in Vopnik Chervoninkis theory was my own little intrusion of the Anglo-Saxon vocabulary into the august world of mathematics. Here's a fancy-pantsier one, and that's the phrase Markov chain renaissance. A little wordsmithing that occurred during the course of trying to sell the world on having the IMA special year. But there really has been a renaissance in the theory of finite Markov chains. 20 years ago, the theory of finite Markov chains was actually almost a mathematical joke in terms of the way that people thought the theory was complete. Rota actually said, it's trivial to write a book on any subject that's completely well understood. And then he says, for example, finite Markov chains. Okay. Now, if you were to write a book on finite Markov chains, it would have nothing to do with that book that Rota thought would have been trivial to write. It would have had completely different motivations for its problems. It would have had a completely different direction for its results. And it would be infinitely richer than it was possible based on what one defined that subject to be at that time. Okay. So there has been a real renaissance in the subject of finite Markov chains. Now I want to talk a little bit about that. I'd intended to incorporate more of that in the lectures. If the lectures had been sort of a balanced education in probability theory of combinatorial optimization, I would have done a bunch on that. But since I really haven't made many personal contributions, or for instance, none, no personal contributions to that subject, I didn't feel like I was really adding much to it. As a matter of fact, I learned now that there's a workshop, a week-long workshop on the Markov chain renaissance going on in Berkeley next week. So if you go home, say hi to your wife and household animals, and then just hop on the plane and go to Berkeley, then you can learn all about the Markov chain renaissance during the course of the next week. The motivations for that came from a couple of directions, one of which is simulated annealing, which I'm sure everybody knows, but let me say a little word about simulated annealing. In particular, there's one phrase that I like to use in describing simulated annealing, and that simulated annealing is really a method for solving all problems. And therefore, it solves some problems better than it solves other problems. And the idea of simulated annealing is that one has begins with a structure, which you can think of as a graph. And one example of such a graph is to have the vertex set be the set of positions of n queens on an n by n chessboard. Okay, that's an example of a vertex. And now what would be the edges? So if I have a chessboard, if you think this is boring, wait till I start coloring in the squares.
You mean non-attacking queens?
Yeah, I'm going to do non-attacking in just a sec. So far, I've just got n queens on a chessboard. But one of the traditional problems that's often used in computer science courses is to write a program using backtrack, whereby you show that you can place n queens on an n by n chessboard such that no pair of queens is attacking. This is the sort of the generic program that you write at the end of a one-semester course, Introduction to Programming. So Queen's course can move along diagonals, and they can move along rows, so there would be two positions where the Queens would not be attacking. And a typical sort of question is, place in Queens so they are non-attacking. That is, they don't attack each other. Now, if we wanted to have a graph that represented what we're interested in the in Queens problem, we could take the set, V set to be the set of all positions of in Queens on a chessboard. And if that's the problem we were interested in, we may as well always restrict attention to where the queens are in. See, this is a much better word. 60% of thinking is having the right words. Rook good position. Okay. Now, we call a set of queens a rook good if they're non-attacking, if they just get to move like rooks, which really is the same assertion as that they're already in positions of permutation. So, for example, if I now placed a queen here, those three queens would be in rook good position. No pair attack each other as rooks, but they wouldn't yet satisfy our problem. They wouldn't be queens that had the property that they were non-attacking as queens. Those pair attack along a diagonal, but they don't attack as rooks. Okay, so let's take the vertex set to be the set of positions of n queens on an n by n chessboard where the queens are in rook good position. And an edge, I have to tell you how to go from one of these vertices to another vertex. And the idea is, how many people in here are colorblind? All right, so we got, so red's bad, red green's bad for you, right? Blue's good. Okay, let's use blue. Let's consider that square and that square. So we saw that if we had if we choose two of our queens at random, they determine a rectangle, and there are two other corners to that rectangle. And if I make the move that goes from that rectangle to this rectangle, then that's a transformation that preserves rook goodness. Okay? And it's also a transformation that I can make easily. I can choose two of my queens at random and perform this rook good transformation, and that gives me another rook good position. Okay. So now I know how to do a random walk on this set of rook good positions. And the problem, if I want to study this issue of simulated annealing, I need a feature of merit. So a feature of a vertex, if I take a vertex which is contained in V, if V is equal to the number of pairs of attacking queens, then the issue of finding a placement of n queens on the chessboard such that they're non-attacking boils down to the problem of minimizing this function that's defined on a large finite set. Or, since I've got edges defined, we say there's an edge given by that story down below. So now I've got a function defined on a graph, and the goal is to minimize it. Minimize F. Well, here's my trick. Here's the way I think about this. Consider a probability measure indexed by T, and it's going to be a probability measure on V, so I have to tell you what the probability of an individual V is. And it's equal to E to the minus f of v times t, and I'm going to do times, divided by e to the minus f of w t, summed over all w and v. That's a probability measure because I've just normalized it to be one. Okay? Now, let's look at this probability measure. It's been known since the days of Laplace that if you have a ratio like this and t goes to infinity, then this probability measure becomes more and more concentrated on those values of v for which f is small. A large value of f would make this scream into zero. It's actually 17, isn't it? So that's a result due to Laplace. Okay. Now, here's how you solve the N Queens problem. Pick yourself a large T. Choose a point at random according to this probability measure and report the number that you've chosen back at random. Since that probability measure is concentrated on the set where F of V is small, very likely to get a small value. And in fact, in this case, you're lucky in that if you get back to the value zero, you know that you've actually solved the N Queens problem. Okay. Now, that's the one component of what's necessary in the theory of simulated annealing. There's another component, and that is, how do you choose a point at random from this probability measure? In particular, because if this is... If you've got n queens, the number of elements of the state space is n factorial. So for n equal to 100, you couldn't even compute that denominator. Okay. So how do you choose an element at random from that probability measure? Well, that turns out to be pretty easy. Choose at random, thanks. At random. How do we do it? Make a random walk with stationary measure PTV. Well, how can you do that? Well, one easy way to do that is to choose PIJ that satisfy the total balance condition that's necessary for a reversible Markov chain. That's actually a trick that was invented in a paper by Metropolis, Teller, and Teller. And one of these Tellers is the guy that has the epithet Father of the Hydrogen Bomb. So this showed up in the course of that work. Okay, but that's not hard to write that down, and indeed you can kind of sort of do that. That's called a Metropolis algorithm, and you can sort of, how do you do that? Well, you pick your T, you run this for a long time till you get tired, and then you stop and report whatever V you've got. Some questions there about how you might want to run it. Now, there's one absolutely. Now, all this is known as of 1953. I mean, we've got this result of Laplace. We've got this result about stationary measures. We've got this result due to Teller, which is 1953 result. And now the issue is, what's new? Well, it's an epsilon, and it's an irrelevant epsilon. But what sort of got the people excited about the subject of simulated annealing was, let's take a step according to the Metropolis algorithm, and then let's increase our T. And let's take a step according to the Metropolis chain, and then let's increase our T. So changing the temperature as you make your walk was, in some sense, the trick that got people excited and interested in the subject, which is then called simulated annealing. There was yet another variation on that that said, because if we're going to make something like a sword, we know that if we want to have a nice crystalline structure, one of the things that happens out there in that world is that you not only heat things up and then cool them down, but you heat them up at the end again and you cool them down. So not only might we take a bunch of steps with decreasing T's, but at some point, increasing T's, but at some point we might decrease our T's, take some steps, et cetera. So this is lead to the notion of a non-monotone annealing schedule. Okay, well, this is a simple problem, and it's one I've actually implemented, and it works like a charm. Provides the answer to in-queen problems very quickly, very pleasantly. You always know you've got the right answer, and we were able to get the answer. This was circa 1987. We were always able to get the answer in a minute or so. That's no big deal because we knew how to solve this in-queen's problem. Anyway. Big. Yeah, there are a lot of problems. How long do you run the chain? How big do you take T? Why did I pick F, not the square root of F? Infinitely many variations on simulated annealing, and you never know. There's very little wisdom about there. I mean, there's an evolving school of wisdom, but there's very little wisdom about how you make those choices. There is some very recent progress and interesting progress, but kind of bad news progress, based on coupling ideas that tell us when you've exactly achieved an element of that stationary distribution. Those ideas were sort of versions of that idea were known a long time ago. If you pick two points at random as your starting places and you move them both and then you stop when they hit, then there are some mathematical arguments that say that there's a good chance that this is going to be a genuinely uniform place. So there are some variations on that rule, but basically nobody who does simulation uses any of those. Nobody who does simulation anything uses any of those because they're disappointingly slow. Now, so I've been kind of skeptical about this. And now there's some rich mathematics because if you actually change those T's, you have to think harder about non-temporally homogeneous Markov chains than people had become accustomed to thinking. And there's some real technology to be evolved there. But now let me make some positive statements about simulated annealing, about when I would use it. If I were just going to solve the in-queens problem, and that's all I had to solve, I probably wouldn't use simulated annealing. But if I was working in an environment where a guy came into me and he said, well, yes, queens move like that, but if a queen's in one of the first four squares in the center of the board, they can also move like knights. Well, I'd say, you son of a bitch. I have to change all my code. It's going to be a big mess. Well, if I've done this in the context of simulated annealing, all I have to do really is change my feature of merit. I can still keep the same structure. I can still keep the same walk. I can still keep the same T. I just have to change the feature of merit because now some pairs that weren't attacking before can become attacking. And he says, well, that's right, except if there's also a queen, da-da-da-da-da-da. So if the guy keeps, if you're in an environment where guys keep changing the rules on you, and there are a lot of such environments, then having some pretty automatic rule, even though you don't know all the limit properties of this rule, can be a very handy thing. So there's simulated annealing is here to stay. It's got an evolving theory. The theory is not supportive of the way it's used in practice, but practice is quite robust and growing. Yeah, Howard.
Didn't Johnson Trump actually work quite well
for the I haven't heard him report on that. I mean, you probably have to set it up brilliantly because I tried it on a trailing salesman problem and it worked terribly. Oh, that's good. That's good. But it didn't do quite as well as Lin Canaan, but that's a balanced. Right. Now, some of the theoretical results on this are results by Hayek, who showed that in the case of matching problems, you could prove analytically that it wouldn't perform as well as known matching algorithms, which one has. So there are lots of negative cases. The real case that I find most compelling is that it's robust in the variation of the problem in a way in which few algorithms which are genuinely combinatorial are. Yeah.
Did you
in various ways, and it sort of depends upon how they're connected, there exists a tie-in between simulated annealing and complexity theory. And they're actually existed motivated by the theory of simulated annealing, a notion of the depth of a combinatorial problem and what makes one hard, what makes one easy. And this idea of depth is, if I'm plotting out the state space V as if it were just a line, but we know how that works, and up here, I'm plotting essentially f of v, or another measure of the feature of merit. And one of the things that makes a simulated annealing problem either easy or hard has to do with both the number. There are lots and lots of kind of shallow local minimum here, and the shallow local minimum aren't necessarily terrible for us. But sometimes there are reasonably deep local minimum. And here's, let's say, a global minimum. And the feature merit that ends up being interesting, that tends to measure how well simulated annealing will work or will not work, is this distance, h, that you have to rise above your serious local minimum in order to get back out of that well and back into what might be your global minimum. There are some theoretical results on that. They tend to be results of the form of you articulate this feature of merit, you articulate this principle for a type of problem you're interested in, say a matching problem, and then you go ahead and do combinatorics and see what you can prove about H. That's one type of result that there is, and this is work by Klaus Sugar, and he was interested in this. This is kind of motivated by work of Hayek, but once you've got that work of Hayek in place, he sort of explained this idea, H first. Then the idea of Sugar was, let's use H as a measure of the complexity theory of different problems. And so he looked at a variety of problems related to matching and said that in terms of this feature of merit, this problem is more complex than that problem if it has a larger H. So that's one type of theoretical result. Hayek's theoretical result related the H that he was interested in to estimates of the running time of the algorithm of simulated annealing under some probabilistic models and also under a model of a specific annealing scheme, basically having the T go down logarithmically. And I think there's probably more. I just don't know the rest of it. Now, it turns out that there exists a giant literature for simulated annealing that's extremely uneven. You know, there's stuff that just said, you know, here's a problem. I did simulate annealing on it, and here's what I got. And those problems were quite worthwhile at the beginning of the enterprise, but there are now hundreds of such problem papers, and so that's not much of interest anymore. There's an evolving theoretical literature, but it's giant size and very hard to survey and very uneven. You can even take the books. One measure of the maturity of a subject, I think, is you take two books on the subject and you see what the level of overlap of the references is. And if there's a high level of overlap in the references, then at a certain age in the evolution of a subject, that implies that it's a coherent literature. If there's almost a disjunction between the set of references, that implies it's still in a scattered and diffuse state. And that doesn't quite work by the time things have been around old enough to become purely pedagogical. If you take the set of references of two calculus books, the probability that they would overlap at all is zero. So the metric's imperfect. Okay. So that's a little piece about simulated annealing. And if you didn't know what it was, that's a part of the idea, a prejudicial presentation, of course. But it's a little part of the idea of what it is. And there you go. Yeah?
What this notion of
problem. What was it again?
The depth, you have to find, have to scale things right, because this doesn't, you could change f to the square root of f and the depth would change. So it's only an issue up to monotonicity. But basically, it's the, you take the global minimum and you take values, you have to make some choices, which are larger than the global minimum. And then you look at the, for instance, let's look at the specific case. Let's take the global minimum and let's take the second largest value, although this isn't necessarily the case. It's how high up you have to go in the value of your feature of merit
to
get into the watershed of the other one. Exactly. Okay. And the size of that will determine the speed at which you can choose the annealing scheme. Okay. So that's one of the things that motivated the Markov chain renaissance. There's another broad set of motivations which come from, there are a couple of ways. One is how you choose something at random. And a general principle, which can be made quite rigorous, is that your ability to enumerate a set is closely related to your ability to choose an element of that set at random. And there are a lot of sets for which we don't really know how to enumerate them. And among those include the number of matchings which are in a bipartite graph with a bunch of edges, but not all the edges. Okay. André Breuder was the first to observe that by finding a random walk on the set of these perfect matchings, one could then use theory of Markov chains to choose an element at random from this set of perfect matchings. And that gives you an approach, a technique, an idea for thinking about how you enumerate the number of perfect matchings of a graph. That's led to a large theoretical development, and it's led to some interesting results in complexity theory. It hasn't really showed up to be thoroughly practical yet. I don't know of too many results out there in the practical domain where people have used that, but it's certainly been exciting for many people in aspects of theoretical computer science. Okay, another big part of business out there is the relationship, and there are diverse literature on this, is the relationship between worst case behavior and average case behavior in algorithms and also in problems. So, and there's a piece of this that's a little bit more special that I like, and I want to tell you a tiny bit about. The worst case analysis is the traditional way of analyzing algorithms. And that's actually not as bad as it might sound, because it's a tool that guides you in the right direction in many ways. The hard part about doing average case analysis of most algorithms is it's, in many instances, it's hard to convince yourself of the right underlying probability measure. Probabilists are reasonably lucky individuals as opposed to more applied scientists, and that we disregard our probability measures as having descended upon us on a white fluffy cloud. We don't necessarily worry about where they came from. But that's something you do have to worry about if you want to make an honest comparison of worst case and average case analyses. Now, another aspect of worst case analysis is this. Let's go back to our favorite problem, endpoints in the unit square, and let's look at the cost of the TSP tour, LN. And one of the results, we proved that we had the bound, almost sure bound, of a constant times the square root of N. And using the induction argument of Ries, not only does this hold for the TSP, but it holds for virtually every functional that we have any interest in. In particular, if you're homogeneous of order 1, L of the empty set's the empty set, and you have simple subadditivity, then you actually end up with this rather interesting nonlinear bound. So that's an example of a worst-case result, and there are these of various flavors. One that's mentioned in some of the notes there is if you look at the sum of the squares of the edges, E containing the TSP tour, that's bounded by just log N, and that's best possible. And there exists an evolving set of a theory with roots that go back quite far to people who are interested in problems in the plane about the behavior of the worst case behavior of these functionals. So in particular, if you take max over all ln, over all x of ln of x, that ends up being honestly asymptotic to a constant times the square root of n. Okay, and a lot of other functionals exhibit analogous properties. So parallel to much of the theory we've seen, you have a completely analogous worst-case theory. And there are certainly instances where the worst-case theory is easier. There are some instances where it can be as hard, and there are many instances where it can be different. For instance, the worst-case analysis for the two-sample problem is trivially that you get cost order n, whereas we get, for the random case, square root of n log n. In the two-sample random worst-case matching, you'd put all of the, can't use red points, all of the blue points on one side, all the black points on the other side, you'd have to pay cost 1 to do the match, so the worst-case behavior would be order n, whereas we know the average case behavior is n log n. So that's a trivial example of the case where the worst case and the average case can be dramatically different. And kind of the surprising thing is that there are lots of incidences where the worst case behavior and the average case behavior are really quite close to each other. So that's kind of the surprise in the paradigm. Okay. So we got that. Now, there exists a large set of subjects which now have some books that address them. There's a book on randomized algorithms by Mulvaney, and there are more such books on the way. The randomized algorithms are algorithms that make, that use internal randomization at some part of their process. Okay. So certainly these based on random walks are examples of randomized algorithms, but there are lots more, and sometimes it's very simple randomization that's useful. And kind of a crude analogy, it can involve packet collisions in networks. And so by the sort of human personal analogy, suppose that you have, you're coming along a walk, and your rule is that whenever you meet somebody on the walk, you move to the right. But their rule is that whenever they meet somebody on the walk, they move to the left. You know, a Brit, something like that. So you come coming along like this, and you move like that, and then you go like that, and you'd be stuck. Now, if you each had the sensible rule of moving to the right, or if you each had the sensible rule of moving to the left, you could avoid collision. But another way to at least minimize collision is that when you meet head-on, you randomize. Okay. So some instances of the use of randomization on an algorithm are to avoid types of collisions, or to avoid special circumstances. Lots of instances where choosing something at random guarantees a generic circumstance. And one example of that can occur in sorting. So there are certain sorting algorithms where you actually benefit by doing a pre-randomization before applying the sorting algorithm, because it guarantees genericity. Now, there's interesting probability that occurs in constructions, and the most interesting of these are where you prove that there exists an item of a special type that you're interested in by showing that it has positive probability under some probability model. And the interesting instance of this is that you can show that it sometimes has tiny probability. And it's kind of boring when you show that, oh, damn, with probability 1, you choose 1, it works. Okay? It's kind of boring, but it's also kind of handy because it gives you one of the instances. The most interesting aspects of this combinatorial construction are when you prove that something has positive probability, but the probability is still tiny. That way you can't just choose one at random and have one, but you nevertheless prove that one exists. Certainly in that sense, those algorithms are candidates for now an interesting evolving subject, which is called de-randomization, the generic instance of which is you've got an object whose existence is proved by probability theory. You now want to go back and say, let's make this probabilistic existence proof constructive. Or in some instances where you're trying to run an algorithm, what you actually do is go back and not only make your object constructive, but show that you can give decent bounds on the amount of time that's necessary to construct that object or to get that instance that you needed for your path. Okay, well, that does it that on de-randomization. Any one of these subjects, I mean, no doubt there could be K week-long workshops on item four. You could certainly have a week-long workshop on algum one, on item D. You could have K workshops on randomized algorithms and constructions. And right now, I don't think that you'd want to spend a whole day on what we know about worst case versus average case paradigm, but it'd certainly fill up somebody's morning pretty thoroughly. Okay? Thank you very much.